go ahead and grab a seat and join us for a minute or two. You see, what we're actually trying to do here is we're trying to get a feel for how people spend their day at work. So, if you would you walk us through a typical day for you?
Yeah.
Great.
Well, I generally come in at least 15 minutes late. I use the side door. That way Lumberg can't see me. After that, I just sort of space out for about an hour.
Space out?
Yeah. I just stare at my desk. But it looks like I'm working. I do that for probably another hour after lunch, too. I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Hey, Internet. You know that scene in The Matrix where Morpheus offers the red pill or the blue pill? If Neo takes the blue pill, he stays a cubicle drone, oblivious to reality. On this week's episode of the Enthusiasticast, we give you that choice. Read 2009's Shop Class as Soulcraft and free your mind. Or don't, and stay oblivious to the way the world of work really works. But first, John is back from holiday, the back-to-school sales are upon us, and there's this faint shrug in the air. Fall is almost here. That means the publishing cycle is about to disgorge a torrent of potential win. John, let's talk about our five most anticipated fall releases. Welcome back. How did you come up with your list?
My list was basically, I wanted to think of books that I was going to buy no matter what. That was my benchmark for most anticipated. There's a lot of things that I'm interested in that I'm going to take a look at, that I'm maybe going to read some reviews on, that I'm going to, you know, wait to hear about, that I might get to, that I might get from the library. But there's a few books where, you know, I'm in the store day and day, money in hand, and I'm getting that book.
Okay. So
what about you?
Well, I looked at September to December only.
I didn't even go that far. And that was just fall releases, so I went as far as November because I know there's going to be a spate of Christmas releases, and we're probably going to be looking, you know, we're going to be talking about Christmas releases closer to then.
Yeah, true enough. Like, I went to, so I just, like, listed all the ones that I knew about, that I was anticipating that I knew about, and then I poked around on some of the bigger publishers' websites, and, you know, they don't have anything dropping between December 4th and 24th anyway. So
I found that if you go onto Amazon and go into the advanced search function, you can actually set it up so that it gives you a month's worth of titles at a time, so you can see everything that's publishing in the month of September, and then you can sort that by genre and everything, so you can bring it down to like a couple hundred titles at a time and then just quickly buzz through that.
Yeah, that's my methods were a little rougher, but that's essentially what I did. Yeah. Okay, so what's your number five?
My number five is let's go chronological order. So the first book I'm excited about is How to Live in a Science Fictional Universe by Charles Yu.
Cool.
It's a first novel. This guy's a National Book Foundation 5 Under 35 Award winner, and it's just a trippy sounding novel. It's the main character's name is Charles Yu, same as the author. And basically he lives in a universe which is like the universe from a science fiction novel. And people are time traveling all the time, and he's a time travel technician. And his job is basically to fix the mistakes that they make, to save people, to literally save people from themselves, because they go back in time and they meet themselves and they marry their own mothers and they do all kinds of weird shit. But at the same time, apparently based on the advance word, the early buzz, it's very literary and it's very much a human story. Like, it doesn't, you know, it's not plot driven, it's not, you know, space opera, it's not Back to the Future, it's not anything like that. It's just sort of using the mechanics of time travel to tell stories about family. But anyway, basically it's a father and son story. His father disappeared and his mother is now trapped in a 30-minute time loop where she relives the one happy family dinner they ever had over and over and over again and stuff like that. So
yeah, IO9 had like the 10 best things about Comic-Con this year, and mm-hmm. he was on the list.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, so he was like, I don't know, he set up a card table in a hallway at Comic-Con and like just brought the noise, apparently.
I've read interviews with him, and he's a fascinating interview. He's obviously 15 times smarter than I am. So I'm excited to read it on that basis alone.
Okay, my number five is a book, I Live in the Future and Here's How It Works by Nick Bilton. Bilton is a blogger at the New York Times. He's kind of like a millennial in his 20s. He's really tech savvy. And yeah, so with like a title like that, he has to kind of bring the goods. And both in writing and marketing this thing, I think he's going to do it. I'm excited because he wrote it with his readership's kind of digital needs in mind. So like there's embedded QR codes in the text, which you can scan with your camera and like go to extra content on the web and have like videos download your iPhone and stuff. Awesome. So, you know, it sounds a little gimmicky, but if anyone can pull it off, I think Nick can. So that's it.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah.
All right. My number four, I suspect this might be on your list as well, also dropping September 7th, is Zero History by William Gibson. So that's one of the gimmies on my list. I'm getting it not because there's anything per se about this book, which is interesting to me, although it does sound interesting, but I'm a William Gibson fan. I enjoyed Pattern Recognition. I enjoyed Spook Country. I really think that him writing in the like the present near future has kind of re-energized his writing. So this is the third in the trilogy that's not a trilogy, the Big End trilogy, Big End being the sort of shady corporate character who's been in the background in the other two novels. And once again, it's a getting the band back together, you know, putting together a team of super cool archetypes and sending them out for some, you know, weird, hyper slick literary MacGuffin. And I like that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. My number four is Merlin Mann's book on time, attention, and creative work. I looked for this title and a release date on the web, and I couldn't find one, so it might not be this fall after all. But I'm okay. Excited. I'm excited for it because you know, books on being effective at work tend to be glib, and I know that Merlin, from his work on the internet and stuff, is, you know, he makes me think he'll deliver real insight. Okay. So fingers crossed that this thing chips.
I'm interested in books on appearing effective at work. So my number three, this is like, this is my total genre, it's just pushing my buttons. I really don't know if this book is going to be any good at all, but it's called Out of the Dark. It's by a guy named David Weber, who writes military science fiction and alternate history stuff. And I've never read a single one of his books. He's written apparently 30 novels. He's one of those guys, you walk into the science fiction section and he's got, you know, a huge sort of swath of real estate there. So I don't know if he's a great writer or not, but obviously, you know, he has a following and he can probably, just on a mechanical level, he can tell a story. And so the deal with this book is, and it didn't get me until the very end where it hinted at the reveal, which I'm going to spoil. And basically it's about an alien invasion of Earth. The aliens come down, they just start blowing shit up and taking shit over. And it looks like humanity is completely screwed. It's Independence Day. And then vampires show up. So, so basically, you know, it's a universe where like, vampires are real, but they've been hanging out, you know, in the shadows, not letting people know they exist. And then when like complete global genocide is going down, they're like, okay, listen, like we should probably step up here and help you guys out. Otherwise, you know, like you're our food source and you're getting wiped out. So, you know, we're going to throw you a bone. We're going to help you out with this alien thing. So it's like humans and vampires versus aliens. And I like military science fiction generally. And I like vampires when they act like superheroes. So
amazing, amazing. I ran across this YA book called Zombies Versus Unicorns.
Oh, yes, I've heard about that.
Anyway, my number three is Arrival City by Doug Saunders. I followed Saunders' newspaper writing for years. I think he's brilliant. He's just kind of like an original mind. Like to the point when I was in publishing school a few years ago, I pitched an imaginary nonfiction book by Saunders to my professors. And so now I'm interested to see the real thing. It's a trend book basically about what's going to happen when the next generation of migrants become middle class. So it's not, you know, it's not filled with excitement, but I'm excited for it. So
awesome. Okay. That sounds interesting. My number two pick is, I've talked about this before on the show, The Outfit by Darwin Cook. So Darwin Cook did a graphic novel adaptation of The Hunter, which is the first book in the Parker series by Donald Westlake, writing under the pseudonym Richard Stark. The Outfit is number two. So The Hunter was awesome. It was one of my favorite books of last year, and I'm expecting further great things from The Outfit, especially given that I've read the first chapter in the form of like a one-off convention special comic that they put out called The Man with the Getaway Face.
Perfect, perfect. I figured that would pop up, yeah.
Yeah.
So
number two.
Yeah, right? So the first three books that I mentioned were all people that I have either met or have a connection with online. You know, that connection doesn't necessarily scale to our audience or anyone else. It's just like I've got a personal interest.
Right.
So these last two, one's a kind of an idiosyncratic novel by Sheila Hetty. It's called How Should a Person Be? There's no description on the web. There's no cover on the web. There is a date. It's happening September 7th. And, you know, if it's from Hetty, it promises to kind of be like edgy, idiosyncratic. We talked about her, or I brought her up when we talked about kind of the 30 best writers under 30.
Right.
And she's definitely like probably the one kind of Canadian that was passed over for that. So look forward to that from her.
Excellent. And my number one is The Vaults by Toby Ball. And this is, it's a first novel. Don't really know much about Toby Ball. Apparently he works in like a correctional facility for children or victims of crime against children. I don't know. But the novel is like a crime novel set in a dystopian 1930s USA where it's just the city. It's not New York or Chicago or Boston or anything like that. And there's three characters who all in various ways uncover that something is corrupt in the city. There's a socialist private investigator. There's a muckraking journalist. And there's an archivist. And the archivist works in the titular vaults. And he basically sort of believes in the purity of the ecosystem of the archives. And so when he discovers a duplicate record that has a discrepancy from the original, it sort of tips him off. And so he's basically sort of your ultimate nerd hero. And that kind of thing works for me. And the advance word on this, some of the early reviews that I've read, Publishers Weekly gave it a really strong review. And it just sounds like a really tight, fast-paced novel thriller.
Wicked. That sounds amazing. So my number one, Zero History from William Gibson, kind of probably lacking in imagination there, but I was just like, in terms of like big books that other people are going to be excited about, you included, Zero History's up there. I have read Spook Country. I don't believe that you have. That just kind of wet my palate for more of Big End and the crew. So I'm dialed in for that. Interestingly, there's like a ton of books that are out now that I can't wait to get my hands on as well. Giles Blunt, my boy, has got a new John Cardinal mystery. It's coming out August 10th, which is next week, and that's my honorable mention because it wasn't in the zone.
Right, and there's actually look for it on the blog. My cutoff was September 1st. and August is a slow, slow month as the industry kind of takes a deep intake of breath before just sort of flooding the shelves with all the new stuff. August 31st, the last release date in August, loaded with good stuff. So you're going to see an If Only We Could Read Faster that has, you know, just a ton of things on it.
Awesome.
So that being said, those are the 10 books that we're excited about for the fall. You're excited about a book this week, and it is
Shop Class as Soulcraft by Matthew Crawford.
And this was a big book about a year ago. I remember you mentioned Slate to me. I listened to the Slate Political Gabfest of all things, and this got a shout out on their Cocktail Chatter, which is like their, you know, their roundup at the end of the show where they just talk about anything and everything, whether or not it's got to do with politics. And, you know, one of the contributors mentioned this book, which is how I'm aware of it. At the time, you know, I was kind of on the fence. I don't really listen to them for book recommendations, so it didn't carry a ton of weight with me. But you obviously, you dug it. So tell me about it.
Well, the fact that I'm endorsing this is kind of an accident. Like, it wasn't a destination book for me. I also heard that podcast. And actually, I thought I was going to hate it, you know. But I got a copy for free. I gave it a whirl, and here we are. So it surprised me. I was like a chapter or two in before it really like pivoted around. I started to groove on it. I really think it's fantastic. It's like flawed in that same way that The Black Swan by Nicholas Nassim Taleb is flawed, but totally worth the read. Now, there's basically three things that I expected. I expected that it was going to be all like new agey, Zen of the Motorcycle Maintenance, of the Celestine Prophecy 2 kind of thing.
Right.
I thought it was going to be an exercise in nostalgia and self-justification by the author, and I'll explain that in a second. I thought it would likely have some commentary on kind of like the soullessness of knowledge work sharecropping, you know, and that like Neo come down the rabbit hole kind of thing. And there's none of the first. There's a little of the second, and to my surprise, there's a ton of the third. And what he says about kind of the modern state of work is compelling and well argued, and that was kind of the heart of the enjoyment of the book for me. So, you know, gearheads looking to get into this, I read one review by a guy that was like clearly entering from that perspective, and he was like, oh, there wasn't enough like him talking about working on a 454 Chevy. There's a little, but not a lot.
Okay.
So, you know, and you know, like there's tons of books that are like, oh, you know, we're getting dumber by generations and we need to like return to honest American values and stuff like that. And I was just like, oh God, this is going to be one of those. But
using working with your hands as a stand-in for sort of a whole set of cultural norms that existed in somebody's imagination 50 years ago.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, thank God. It's not like it doesn't hit you over the head with that kind of nonsense. So Right. The author, motorcycle mechanic, grew up in California, you know, was tinkering with cars in high school. He did some work as an electrician during the summers in university. He got a graduate degree or two. He's a PhD, doctoral guy. Got a job at a Washington think tank and then basically checked out. And, you know, hence the self-justification that I mentioned. I was worried that it would be like him being like, here's how you be like me.
Right.
Now, the book's got a little biography to it. There's a fair bit of, like, honest man making an honest living talk. And you'd expect that, I guess. But what I liked ultimately was that it wasn't the kind of lament for, you know, the, you know, Preston work ethic or whatever, right? So,
right.
Instead, it's like got a ton of like dense ideas and observations, and like dense to the point where there's like the small S self, and then there's the large S self, like, you know, okay, in university, where it's like, you know, capital B being and little b being, you know. And I was just like, I just had a bit of a flashback. So he talks about, you know, America's fetishization of things homemade. He talks about dealing with like intractable problems and how that tempers one's relationship with the world. You know, he's got this phrase about the false sense of autonomy you have through consumer choice, right? Like, you're not really interacting with the world by picking what coffee table defines you as a person out of the IKEA catalog, you know?
Right.
He talks about how kind of there's the Western liberal ideas of autonomy and democracy paint us into a corner in the workplace. He's just like, those ideas that we celebrate in the public sphere and in politics about, you know, like separation of church and state and stuff like that, like those actually seep into the workplace and get us into trouble, which I thought was interesting. He talks about, you know, he talks about the fact that job classes are disappearing across America. You know, as students get into university and then, you know, get out into the workforce, and it turns out kind of their expectations of the white collar world are upside down. Talks about economics, macroeconomics, management philosophy, the ethics of building. Like, it's really dense, and there's just great observations. So, why read this thing? I guess, you know, the reviewer in Slate called it the best self-help book he has ever read. And to a point, I agree. Like, this is actually a great business book too. And you know how, like, typically the business self-help category books are all bullshitty, you know? They use some far-flung piece of research to support the 7 ways to be indispensable to your boss and all that nonsense. Like, there's hardly any prescription in this book. Instead, Crawford is like, you know, that anxiety or unease you feel at the job, here are some kind of compelling reasons why that might be. You know, you can't have true self-knowledge if the self in question is this like evolving personal fantasy of your own creation kind of thing. So, yeah. So it's not for everybody. It surprised me. But it's just like a great book of kind of of diagnosis, right? It's a description, not prescription, of just kind of how work is as a white collar knowledge worker in North America. And, yeah. So it's just like, yeah, that's my pick. So Shop Class as Soul Craft by Matthew Crawford. It was in hardcover last year and I didn't check, but I anticipate it coming out in trade paper before Christmas.
That sounds really interesting. I like that observation about the fact that shop classes are disappearing. I mean, you always hear about the arts programs disappearing, right? But it's interesting that it appears to be happening from the other end as well. Until, I guess, like, what's less, like, business and IT?
Yeah, he's just like, I've got this buddy in Chicago, and he's got all this great equipment, and it all came from the schools. And so, like, there's a great purge in the 90s where they just, like, dismantled all the shop classes and put in computer labs, right? Because that was seen as the thing to do. But he makes this point about how, you know, like, dealing with intractable problems, like dealing with a set of conditions that you have to mold to as a problem solver, is so much different than the problem solving that you get from like creative work, where, you know, you can manipulate the facts to meet your outcome.
Right.
So it's just like, yeah, like we don't, We don't teach kids in class that life kicks back sometimes, you know, and that's a valuable thing. And so it.
So is there any prescription at all in it? Like, is there any, you know, here's some things you might try, like.
Yeah, you know. But it's not like preachy prescription. It's more like Michael Pollan, you know, in terms of, well, I guess In Defense of Food is really prescriptive, but Omnivore's Dilemma is just like, okay, here's kind of the socioeconomic macro conditions that got us to this place,
right.
And it's not the ideal place, right? And so, you know, I'm sure if you sat him down, Crawford, in an interview, he could nail off a bunch of things, but, you know, he says stuff like, you need to, the separation of work and output, the further apart they are, the more kind of alienation the worker feels. So, like, one thing is to put those closer together. So, kind of, he's kind of the locavore of work in that way, right?
That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's doubly compelling because of the, you know, of the outsourcing fears in America right now.
Sure.
And like, you know, so he talks about how if what you do on a daily basis can be done over a wire, you're kind of in trouble.
So,
you know, because the work that you do or the output that you do is subject to the downward price pressure of globalization. And so you get this kind of clerkdom where white collar work is kind of broken up into mindlessly following directions in the way that blue collar work has already happened in blue collar work.
Right.
So, you know, and he just puts that forward as an example because, like, he doesn't get into, like, creating code, for instance, right? So if you're a website programmer, of course that can be done in India or over the wire as well. But, you know, he talks more about the service industry and stuff like that.
Do you think that this is going to have an impact on how you approach work, having read it, or how you think about the work that you do?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of the reviews that I saw online, like, cited Zen in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which is clearly, right. Like, he clearly makes some homages to,
sure.
But ultimately dismisses. And I've never read that book.
I have read it. I was altered, so
yeah. So
I can't give it an honest review.
And so, you know, I was, like I said off the top, I expected more of that and had no interest in me. So I'm someone that took shop class in high school every year, and so this is this hit home a little bit for me more than the average person because, you know, have a motorcycle, it won't bend to my will.
I was going to say, does this mean that you're going to finish reconstructing that bike? is the engine
excited? Well, it's got long passages about how, like, demoralizing it is, right? And I was just like, yes, this is so true. This is so true. So yeah, like, I sound like I was a reluctant really reader, but really, like, this speaks to a lot of things that I care about anyway. I just like that it didn't, it, you know, was kind of tempered republicanism. It didn't go all, like, you know, it didn't go all Francis Fukuyama on us, you know, who actually reviewed it for the New York Times.
If you, like, you know, you go home and you nail something and make everything out of wood, like, suddenly your life will be better.
Yeah. It's a complicated book, right? Like, it's just filled with lots of good societal observations. And so one of the things that he does in the book is he makes fun of the wood hippies. you know, the Walden Pond wood yep. hippies that he encountered when he was in California, like kind of the back to the landers. And he like kind of mocks them from a distance. And it's just like, it's all about horsepower. It's all about building, you know, it's all about going for speed and all this stuff. Right. So,
right.
So you can just kind of take that with a, you know, take that for what it is, which is his personal bias. But yeah,
well, I think that's a bias we share. I'm not necessarily for, like, you know, the rape and destruction of the natural world, but at the same time, I don't want to live in a hut, you know? I don't want to be a subsistence farmer.
Right.
So I appreciate anybody whose vision of the now and vision of the future involves, you know, electricity.
Power tools.
But speaking of electricity, I think we're going to turn the lights out here.
Yep.
So the Enthusiasticast is finally in iTunes. Search for the Enthusiasticast to listen to back episodes. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a review. You can check out our blog at enthusiasticast.com for things we are enthusiastic about that we don't talk about on the show. There are a few things spilling over. And leave a comment on the blog or send us an email at hello@enthusiasticast.com. We love all kinds of listener feedback. Until next week, I'm John.
And I'm Mark.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers.